Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, hymns to mark the beginning of the liturgical year. When a pope of the 20th century goes Irish, as he speaks of St. Columban. A sound picture of a Guido Reni masterpiece in a Sri Lankan's cardinal titular church. And on a more erudite note, we join our popular Latin lover, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. I'd like to begin today by marking the imminent beginning of the liturgical year on Sunday, 28th of November. That's on a musical note with Monsignor Philip Whitmore. Stay tuned.
A generation or two ago, a very unpopular job among seminary students was ringing the bell first thing in the morning to get everyone out of bed. The reason it was unpopular, of course, was that it meant getting up even earlier, so as to be ready on time. At the start of Advent, we hear again and again the call to wake up, to get ready, to prepare ourselves for the day that is dawning. We all know how hard that can be if we're feeling sleepy. But we all know how necessary it is if we have something important to do. What could be more important than being ready to greet our Saviour when he comes? Wachet auf, ruft uns die Stimme. Awake, a voice is calling. That's the title of an old German hymn for Advent. The version we just heard was arranged by Michael Praetorius early in the 17th century, but probably more familiar to modern listeners is the arrangement made by J.S. Bach 100 years later. If any of you have worked with church choirs or liturgy planning groups, you'll know how hard it can be to prepare the music Sunday after Sunday for public worship. Imagine what it would be like if you had to compose the music as well. But that's exactly what J.S. Bach did for most of his life. He wrote his cantatas for use during the Sunday liturgy in Weimar and in Leipzig, often producing a new one each week. The cantata he wrote for the last Sunday of November in 1731 was Wachet auf, and he based a lot of the music on the tune we've been listening to. Now, I bet some of you are thinking, yes, it's lovely music, but it doesn't sound much like the tune we heard before. Wait for it. Bach is setting the scene with a beautiful counter-melody, preparing the way for the coming of the tune. Here it is, in long, slow notes, in the voice parts. Listen now to a passage a bit later on, where Bach sets the second verse. Zion hears the watchmen singing. ¶¶ That's the counter melody. Now for the tune. Many people find the spiritual quality of Bach's music a great help with their prayer. It can settle us into a recollected frame of mind. If you get the chance, you may like to listen to a recording of Bach's cantata Wachet auf as part of your Advent devotion. At the heart of it is a dialogue between Christ and the soul. When the heavenly bridegroom comes, he invites the soul to join him at the wedding feast. No eye has ever seen, no ear has ever heard such joy as this.
You were listening there to Monsignor Philip Whitmore, a music historian who is currently working as an official at the Vatican's Secretariat of State. A big thank you to him. And now, why not go arty as we go over to a church now linked in a special way to one of the 24 newly created cardinals who were assigned a titular church here in Rome during last weekend's consistory, becoming in this way members of the Rome diocesan clergy. Just like the church's first cardinals. The cardinal in question being Malcolm Ranjith of Sri Lanka, to whom Pope Benedict allotted a minor basilica in the heart of Rome, San Lorenzo in Lucina. But why don't you join me there with Professor of Fine Arts Breda Ennis as we gaze up in wonder at the focal point of this sacred space, an artistic masterpiece from the 17th century by no other than Guido Reni, depicting the figure of Jesus hanging on the cross in contrast with the menacing landscape in the background. St. Lorenzo is obviously St. Lawrence. Rita, who was Lucina?
She was believed to be a Roman matron who made her own domestic house available for worship on this particular site around the 4th century.
We're walking down the central nave here and we're going towards a very beautiful picture above the altar, which I believe, Breda, is one of your favourites. It's a Guido Reni.
This is a famous Bolognese painter, but this is a piece of work of his not so well known, even though it was very well known in the past centuries.
You told me once on an earlier tour that we had in Santa Maria del Popolo that he was a pupil of the Baroque artist Carracci.
Yes, in fact.
I have a good memory.
I'd almost forgotten myself.
So we have Christ on the cross here. There's a lot of light. Shall we sit down on a bench? Rita, this is a beautiful picture which is encased in a marble Baroque structure. The light is on the figure of Jesus on the cross.
Yes, in fact.
And I imagine that there's St. Peter's in the background.
Yes, it's like a sort of darkish landscape with what looks like the dome of St. Peter's on the horizon, with a little light coming up behind St. Peter's, and in the front you have various fields, etc. And then floating up from all of that, at least it seems so, even though the cross is in the ground, you get the feeling that the cross is suspended in another dimension. In this sense, this painting by Reni is very modern. When you look at it for the first time and try not to be influenced by what you know about it, you get the feeling that it could have been painted a century ago. In fact, it was done in the 1600s.
Why do you say that, Breda?
Because there seems to be no particular connection with any specific period of art. It seems like he's mixed a lot of different things, like classical landscapes, with a Christ figure which is not full of pain and marks and wounds. You just get the feeling that he's taken the Christ figure out of how we know it generally, like Christ on the cross with visible wounds, with blood dripping from the side and from the hands. Here, instead, you get the feeling that Christ is transfigured. He's already off the cross and in the clouds, in the celestial heavens. For this reason, I think it has some kind of incredible magical element, which no other cross has, as far as I'm concerned. I've seen so many paintings of crosses and crucifixions, early ones, later ones, but this one here is, for me, the most sublime. And I know that in the 17th, 18th and 19th century, people, when they came to do the Rome tour, came here specifically to see this painting by Guido Reni. Not so much nowadays, because it's gotten cancelled out by some more famous places, but I do think, in terms of contemplation and spirituality, it's one of the best I've seen. If you look at the colours, this pale light that seems to come from nowhere, it's almost like there's a heavenly light on the figure of Christ, which is contrasted with the dark, cloudy, sort of semi-stormy atmosphere behind in the landscape. There's a total contrast between a sense of menace that you get in the background and yet this wonderful sense of liberty from the Christ figure, who is floating above all of us, floating above reality. And again, this is the part where Christ becomes God in the true sense, because also you see around the crown of thorns a halo of light. He didn't put in one of those classical golden halos around the head, which people would normally have done. Also, the flesh seems alive. So the figure of Christ is not full of pain. He's beyond that. He's gone on to the next stage. So in a way, he's suspended between the earth and just about to move into heaven.
And many thanks there to Breda Ennis, who's currently working as a professor of fine arts at the American University of Rome. Meanwhile, why not turn our attention to a figure dear to the Irish whose feast day the church remembered this week on the 23rd of November. I'd like to do this by bringing you the words of Pope Benedict XVI, as well as those of an earlier pope, Pius XII, in this very special feature I've prepared for you. On at least a couple of occasions, Pope Benedict XVI shone the spotlight on the figure of Saint Columban, more popularly known in Ireland, or so my Irish colleagues tell me, as Columbanus. And as my Irish colleagues also pointed out, not to be confused with Saint Columba, who founded a monastery on the island of Iona. Well, I hope I haven't confused you. At any rate, let's listen to Pope Benedict speaking of Saint Columban, one of the many Irish monks who contributed to the re-evangelization of Europe in the early Middle Ages. Columban, then, who made his profession in the city of Bangor, where he was ordained a priest, and who left his monastery at what was then a very ripe age, 50, travelling to the continent.
He left the monastery to begin missionary work in Europe. The entire regions had lapsed into paganism. Beginning in Brittany, Columban and his companions established monasteries at Angri and Luxeuil. These became centers for the spread of the monastic and missionary ideals brought by the monks from their native island.
Columban, Pope Benedict stressed, introduced to Europe the Irish penitential discipline, including private confession, stern moral teachings which led to conflict with the local bishops and the Frankish court, resulting in the exile of the Irish monks, first to the Rhineland and then to Italy, precisely at Bobbio, which is situated between the cities of Milan and Genoa, where he established a great monastic centre and where he worked for the conversion of the Arian Lombards and the restoration of unity with the Bishop of Rome.
It was there that he died. leaving behind not only the example of an austere monastic life, but also copies of writings which shaped the monastic culture of the Middle Ages and thus nourished the Christian roots of Europe.
As we've just heard, Pope Benedict on this occasion highlighted in a particular way St. Columban's role as a pioneer in bringing Christian civilization to what was then, as a pope of the 20th century, Pius XII, once described as a semi-barbarian Europe. In fact, this Roman pontiff also highlighted the figure of St. Columban, as I discovered while rifling through our very own Vatican Radio archives. So if you're just a little bit curious, do stay tuned as we step back in time, but do watch the change of pace and tone.
Via August Muira, Yves Eklan Gidisch Naheran, August Gogomar.
What you've just heard is a rare recording of Pope Pius XII speaking in an unusual language for a Roman pontiff, Irish. God and Mary be with you, he says, warmly welcoming a group of Irish pilgrims. You are at the centre of the Holy Roman Church. The date is the 8th of September 1950, the place an audience hall located in the Pope's summer residence, Castel Gandolfo. And the Pope's greeting, in a brand of Irish elegantly laced with a French accent, received a heated response. As you may recall, in 1950, the Catholic Church was celebrating a holy year. So it was a busy time for the Pope, what with all the special celebrations taking place. Naturally, on his agenda, the reception of pilgrims who journeyed to Rome from across the world to mark this special event. Among them, on this autumn day, were two separate groups of pilgrims from Ireland. The first group were members of the Knights of St. Columban, for whom Pius XII was quick to abandon his linguistic prowess in the Irish language, resorting to more familiar English instead. In an effort to better describe the man who had inspired this group, St. Columban.
How that name Columban rings clear down the lengths of 1400 years.
The Irish monk who pioneered Christian civilization, not only at home, but abroad.
That saint, that heroic figure of a scholar and apostle on his way to pioneer Christian civilization in a half-barbarian Europe. France, Germany and Italy, where to see Christian knowledge and culture awaken to a new life.
A Christian Renaissance, then, spearheaded by this saintly monk who had lived 14 centuries earlier, who had brought Rome to half of barbarian Europe, but had never come to Rome himself.
Rome had come to him, as it does to all true Irishmen, and laid claim to the fealty of his mind and heart. When the bark of a Peter was being buffeted by the rising tempest of a heresy, and the waters were lapping the gunwales, it was the bold, courageous, challenging voice of a Columban that resounded above the storm, and there followed a great calm and a peace.
How eminently fitting, then, for the Knights of Columban to bring the saint to Rome by setting up an altar dedicated to him, only a few yards away from the peaceful site of St. Peter's tomb. A gift for which the Pope expressed his gratitude, quoting from a letter of St. Columban to the Pope of his time, Boniface IV.
We will live on the world's rim. We are all disciples of Peter and Paul. The Catholic faith, such as we received it from you, successors of the apostles, we have preserved adamant and without blemish.
Inspiring words indeed, followed a moment later by an anticlimax. Pope Pius XII's unexpected change of tone, directed towards the second group of Irish pilgrims received in audience by him this autumn day, those belonging to the Legion of Mary.
It is the inspiration of the splendid work carried on by the Legion of Mary.
Pilgrims who drew from him words inspired by a dramatically different reality. Trade unions.
Irish trade unions strive to apply the principles of that faith within the vitally important field of social problems, accept them as basic in their deliberations and in the formulation of the policies, let the encyclical letters of our predecessors and our own addresses and messages point for them the path that leads to peace between labor and management.
Two very different messages for two Irish groups, which ended with one same blessing.
To all here present, and to all your beloved ones, at home in the Erin and overseas, we impart the apostolic benediction. Receive it as a pledge of heaven's choicest blessings, as a precious token of our unbounded paternal affection. Sit nomen Domini benedictum. Adiutorium nostrum in nomine Domini. Benedicat vos omnipotens Deus, Pater et Filius et Spiritus Sanctus. Amen.
I hope you enjoyed that program put together thanks to our Vatican Radio archives. Finally, on a more erudite and lighter note, I'd like to end by joining our popular Latin lover, Carmelite, Father Reginald Foster. Watch a change of pace and tone. Here in Rome, Latin heritage is also on the signs of restaurants. There's a restaurant on the Via Appia called Quo Vadis.
Ah, yeah.
Why Quo Vadis?
Quo Vadis, of course, it means whither are you going? To what place are you going? That's all. You have to know that stuff.
Talking about going places, when we journalists here at the radio do some on-the-street recordings, we refer to them as vox pops. The vox populis, no?
Populi, vox populi.
I always get it wrong, don't I? Why yeah. Populi?
Well, because it's of the people. The voice of the people is populi, vox populi. Used to famous thing was vox populi, vox Dei. The voice of the people is the voice of God. That was the old democracy bit. So Vox Pops. But there's no S there. The second word shouldn't have an S because there's no S in it.
I need to get back to my books, don't I?
Yes, Vox Pop would be all right. Vox Pop would be all right. But not Pops. Okay.
If I had to translate the word taxi, that's part of the Roman scene. They didn't have taxis in the time of the
No, but they had Romans. Something very, very close to it, you see. They rented their chariots for transportation. Now, you probably don't, this is a whole story here. But anyway, the word to make money is mere or merere, to merit. So we had, for example, arciera or arreda meritoria was a chariot that made money for you. Well, there's your taxi, no?
That's right.
And the fact is, you probably, this is church talk, but people would know it, and the Italians would know it. Meretrix is a prostitute. Meretrix, huh? Someone who made money, kind of doing what she was doing. And Meretricium, this is all in the fathers of the church. Meretrix, the big prostitute of, you know, Babylon and all this other stuff. But it comes from the same word meritoria, to make money. So we would say a taxi is a rida meritoria. A chariot that makes money. Got the idea? So that's the idea I mentioned last time or some other time. It's not the words. We have all the words. Some of the concepts are very hard.
One of the things we mentioned last time we spoke was a concept that didn't exist in Roman times, which was the concept of Star Wars. How does one say Star Wars?
Ah, well, that's easy. Bella Sideria. Bella or Wars Sideria. Among the constellations of the stars. That's easy. Sideria Bella, or there are many other words, but that's very easy. The words themselves we've had for centuries.
Nuclear war would be more difficult, right?
Yeah, again, you say nuclear, bellum nucleare, bellum atomicum nucleare. You understand why? Because in Latin, nucleus, of course, is the center of the nut, as you say in English, the same, the nucleus. And so the nuclear part was when you got down to the inside of the atom and broke apart the seed or the nut of an atom, that is the nucleus of an atom, and that's where the energy comes from, and that's where you have a nuclear war, because you're breaking apart the pit or the seed of the atom. That's all. Ah, it's all incredible.
And heartfelt thanks there, as always, to our popular Latin lover, Carmelite, Father Reginald Foster, who's now teaching Latin in Milwaukee in the United States, but spent almost all of his life as papal Latinist. And that brings me up to time. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back again at the same time tomorrow. Meanwhile, why don't you check out our website? The address is www.vaticanradio.org/English. Bye for now. You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio, Laudetur Jesus Christus.